The Conservative Party is preparing for an election, fighting on two fronts, as the Prime Minister said last night, against Labour and against UKIP. And that, of course, is the theme of much of this party conference in Birmingham. George Osborne's announcement on benefits and pensions yesterday was evidence of political judgment, connected to that election perhaps, as well as part of a strategy to cut the deficit. But this party is also, day-to-day, in a coalition government that's throwing up day-to-day difficulties, not least in the arena of international conflict in which this country is once again involved. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, is making proposals today that she says would follow a Conservative victory next spring that would introduce a new regime designed to prevent the growth of extremism, a problem that haunts so many Western governments. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, is here. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Good morning.
Now, before you took office, you said, and I quote, "We were in danger of living in a control state." Your party is now proposing to ban organisations that can't be prosecuted under anti-terrorism legislation and introduce something called an extremist disruption order, which would mean that the movements of individuals were restricted. They couldn't broadcast, that access online would be restricted. Now, that is exactly the kind of state that you used to complain about. Why is it necessary?
Well, I don't accept that. I think what we had under the last government was what I would call a sort of ineffective authoritarianism. We had plans for identity cards, which would have put obligations on millions of entirely innocent citizens while not actually dealing with the problems. But I've always said, and you can trace this back to 2005 when I became leader of the Conservative Party, we have to deal with the extremism in our midst. And as Theresa May will say today, not just the violent extremists that obviously should be banned and prosecuted, but also those extremists who know how to navigate the line between what is currently legal and illegal, but nonetheless who poison young minds in these online sermons and end up with people wanting to commit terrorist acts or to travel to Syria and take part in brutal activity.
Well, nobody
and for too long we've been tolerant of this sort of behaviour, and I think we need to be a little bit more intolerant of it.
Well, I'm sure most people listening are as intolerant of it as you are and dislike it as much as you do. The question is whether you, by introducing this kind of regime, you can actually stop it, or whether you create actually more resentment than you do in preventing
this from
happening.
Well, that is always the question, and it's absolutely the right one to ask. But my judgment is that at the moment, our ability to ban extremist organisations is limited by the fact that it has to be ones that especially espouse violence rather than the extremist narrative that that violence is based on. I'd also say when it comes to having civil orders to prevent the activities of some of these people, it's about making sure you've got the tools in the toolbox that the police and the security services need to use. At all times, you've got to be cognizant of civil liberties, and we mustn't give up the liberties that we fight to defend. But I think these are two very useful steps Theresa May will be setting out this morning that will help to keep us safer.
Well, they involve, as I understand it, looking at the announcement that's coming, a broadcasting ban. Do you think the broadcasting ban on Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness in the long run did any good?
Well, I mean, I'll leave that to the historians. I think there were very good reasons for it being put in place in the first place. But let's be frank about this. You know, we do face a generational struggle against a poisonous narrative of extremism. People have been asking me, when will it end in Iraq and Syria? And it's difficult to put a date on that. But frankly, we're going to be fighting this for a generation. We see extremism coming out of Nigeria, coming out of Yemen. We've seen it coming out of Afghanistan. And we see it in our own country. And we do have to deal with the fact that young people have been radicalized in our universities, even in our prisons, and it's not good enough just to say, let's go after the men of violence. You've actually got to tackle the narrative of extremism head on. It's a bit like, I think the last government's approach was too much like saying, well, look, we've got to go after Combat 18, but actually let's use the National Front almost to say that's okay, but violence isn't okay. Look, it's all not okay. It's not okay to preach this extremist narrative, and we need to do something about that.
You talk about a generational struggle. That means, although you've indicated you won't put a date on it, that people should be aware that we are going to be involved in conflict in the Middle East for years to come.
What we're going to be involved in is part of an international comprehensive strategy, one part of which is military. But the truth is that we won't solve the problem of extremist terror coming out of the Middle East until these countries have good, strong governments that represent all of their people. As Ban Ki-moon put it, a missile can kill a terrorist, but it's only when you have good governance that you kill terrorism. And that's the case in Iraq, that's the case in Syria. And I don't want to blind people with some idea that we can fix this quickly. We can't.
No, you can't. And you can't fix it without being involved in Iraq, in Syria, surely, because there is, in effect, no border. I mean, Sir David Richards, former very senior figure in the armed forces, was saying the other day, look, this isn't an anti-terrorist operation against a terrorist group. This outfit is bigger. It has a structure. It's got loads of money. It has its own quasi-judicial system, bizarre though we think it is. The Iraq-Syria border has more or less disappeared. Don't you have to accept that at some point, if they're going to be defeated, it involves Syria?
I absolutely accept that, and ISIL needs to be defeated in Syria as in Iraq. As things stand, we're taking part in the action over the skies of Iraq, and Americans and five Arab countries are taking action over the skies of Syria. But where I'd say there's a real similarity is that both Iraq and Syria need the same thing, which is a functioning, democratic, pluralistic government that can represent all of the people, whether they are Sunnis or Shias or Alawites or Kurds. And it's this breakdown of governance that has really led to the appalling
situation. How far away is that in Syria?
Well, I think it is some time away in Syria, because we've got a brutal dictator, Assad, whose massacring of his own people has actually helped to create ISIL. That's been one of the... You ask what it is that radicalizes young men. I would argue that Assad's actions in Syria have been one of the key drivers towards ISIL.
I want to come on to some domestic policy. You're talking today about people having access to Djibouti. You're talking tomorrow, rather, but it's been announced today. That people will have access in the NHS in England to a GP 7 days a week by 2020. I noticed Sarah Wilson, one of your own MPs and is well known, a former GP, tweets this morning, GPs won't like their choices. With Labour, family doctors get wiped out by nationalisation, or with the Conservatives, by seven-day access. In other words, the system can't take it.
Well, the system can take it, and it is taking it, because this is not some fairy tale announcement. Last year, I said we should pilot a seven-day opening, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m.
And five
for
of
GPs.
The seven and pilots weren't operating up to the beginning of this
7
month.
Million people have been covered by those pilots, and they've been a great success, not only because people want to use their family GP service, and as the dad of four children, one of whom was desperately ill, I know how much the family GP service means to people, but also, Jim, it takes a huge amount of pressure off accident and emergency, which people know are open 24 hours a day.
As an ideal.
And so this is working in practice, and across the next government, we deliver it for everyone in the country.
Well, it's an idea to which no one in their right mind could object for the reasons that you've just given. But the NHS has to be funded. Now, you've got problems in the number of GPs who are being trained. I know it's going up.
Yes.
But doctors say that it's not going up enough. NHS England talks about a £30 billion funding gap by 2020. You're saying, well, don't worry, we're going to have seven-day access. That's another little thing. How can a system which is running out of money, despite the increases, which I know you'll cite at the moment, how can that system, without another injection of cash, deal with it?
Well, 24 access, 7 day access for GPs would cost in the next parliament £400 million, and that is out of an NHS budget that is now well north of £100 billion. I will talk about the money, because we've made very difficult decisions in this country about cuts, and I expect we'll come on to some of those, but we decided not to cut the NHS, so it's had £12.7 billion more under this government. And so if you manage the resources well, you are able to make changes like this. But the crucial thing about this change is it actually addresses where the pressure is coming from in the NHS, which is the growing number of frail elderly in our country, that because things inevitably go wrong in their lives, they put enormous pressure on A&E. And if you're a frail elderly person, A&E is not the right place for you. The right place is often in the GP surgery or in an intermediate care environment where you can get help with the ongoing condition that you're dealing with. So this costs money, but I actually think it'll help take the pressure off a key part of the system.
What's interesting about this is that you're clearly saying that you are happy for the NHS to be at the centre of the election campaign. It's an issue in where you tend to do less well than your opponents, for reasons people know. It inevitably means there'll be a huge debate about the extent of private contracting that will occur in the NHS under your watch if you make it a central tenet of your policy. Just let me ask you one question about that. It's about 6%, the private contracts at the moment. Is there any limit to how high you think that could go?
Well, the limit will be set by the GPs.
By the market,
and
that's it.
No, but not by the market. But what we've done is actually put the general practitioners in charge of the health service. If I think of my clinical commissioning group in Oxfordshire, it's run by, overseen by GPs. They make the decisions, and they will drive the change in the NHS. It needs to be more preventative. We need more mental health service, more physiotherapy, more helping people with the things that make them ill in the first place. But there's nothing we've done that fundamentally changes the role of the private or independent sectors in the NHS.
Well, you make it more likely there'll be more private
It'll be driven by the people in charge. It used to be the primary care trusts and the bureaucrats. It's now the doctors. They are the ones that run our NHS, and I would like to pay tribute to the incredible work they've done, because, yes, I'm proud we've protected the NHS budget, but in the past they've been used to bigger increases, and I think they've done brilliantly to treat 1 million more patients, to almost wipe out mixed-sex wards, to radically reduce the number of hospital-acquired infections. The record is a good one. It's been challenging. It'll continue to be challenging. But here's the real point, Jim. You only have a strong NHS if you have a strong economy. Let's look at what happened to the NHS in Greece or Portugal, where they didn't control their deficit and they ended up cutting it by 17%.
Well, one of the ways the Chancellor went about this yesterday was by squeezing most benefits, affecting many people who are at work. I mean, there's one estimate today that about 7 million of the 10 million people who will be affected by the Chancellor's freeze for 2 years on this are people who are actually in work. But what you've also done is, by more changes to those who are older pensions, you're shifting the balance the whole time to those who are generally better off, which didn't used to be the case, and who are older, away from those who are having a very rough time in work. Why?
I don't accept that characterization. Under this government, actually, inequality has gone down and there are fewer children in poverty. Let's look exactly at what George Osborne said yesterday. Now, what this will effectively mean is that between 2007 and 2017, earnings and benefits would have gone up by about the same amount. Now, that, I think, is fair. It would not be fair to put up benefits faster than the earnings of the people who are paying the taxes to pay for the benefits. So, look, this is a difficult choice, but you often say, and I wake up every morning to the Today programme, you often say, when are the politicians going to tell us the truth about where the cuts come from? When are they going to level with the general public? Here we are, in advance of a very difficult election, levelling with people, setting out 25 billion pounds of cuts, 3 billion of which will be funded by this very difficult decision on benefits, but I believe it's fair.
Have you just said or indicated that pensioner benefits are off the table when it comes to cuts?
Well, we've been very clear in our record. We made promises about pensioner benefits and we've kept them. And we've kept a specific promise about the level of the basic state pension, that it should always go up by inflation, by earnings, or by 2.5%, whichever is the greater. And as a result, pensioners have an extra £15 a week in their pockets compared with when I became Prime Minister. Now, I think that's a choice. You often want politicians to make choices. I have made a choice. My government's made a choice, which is to say that we shouldn't ask pensioners to bear the burden of reducing the deficit. You deserve dignity and security in old age after you've worked all your working life.
I think that's the right choice. Their incomes have been going up 30% since 99. This is IFS figure. And non-pensioners have gone up by a much lower figure. Now, that is a choice that you have made. Is that the direction you're going to continue to take?
Well, I believe in, believe it, as I say, dignity and security in old age, and particularly the basic state pension is absolutely key. And we've gone one further than that, because we've actually said what we want the pension to look like in future. Instead of a basic state pension and added to by a pension credit, we're saying there ought to be a single-tier pension of north of £140 a week. And so you know that every penny you save during your working life doesn't get netted off against your pension when you retire. So we've given a very clear direction. I believe it is the right one. We will go out and take it to the country.
Why do so many people in your own party, and it's clear here, don't believe that your promised renegotiation in the EU will produce anything worth having? Why don't they believe you?
Well, it's going to be tough. I think what's interesting about the two people who've defected is actually they were two people who used to say to me in terms, look, I'm not sure you can achieve much with your renegotiation, David, but actually, because I want to leave the EU, I'm happy with what I've got, because you're giving me a referendum where the British people will decide. Now, I think it is possible to renegotiate. Europe has changed because the single currency is driving integration for those countries with the euro. And so I think we're entitled to say, hold on a minute, we're not joining the euro, we're staying outside.
Well, you're entitled to say it. The question is whether you get anything back.
Well, people said I wouldn't be able to cut the EU budget. I cut the EU budget. People say you're never veto a treaty. I vetoed a treaty.
Prime
I've
Minister,
got a track record in Europe of doing what I say I'm going
to
do.
To people in your party who feel so strongly about these matters, that is peanuts. It doesn't change the fundamental relationship. And you know that people like John Redwood, you know, former cabinet minister, we're not just talking about two or three people on the edge who've gone or might go to UKIP. We're talking about a fundamental section of your party which believes that you're nowhere near getting to the heart of the problem.
Well, I would say the overwhelming majority of people in the Conservative Party recognise that the only way of getting the referendum that they want is by having a Conservative government. If you get UKIP, you'll probably end up with Ed Miliband in Downing Street, Ed Balls in the Treasury, which is a nightmare prospect, and no referendum on Europe. And that's why I think you can feel at this conference actually quite a coming together of the Conservative family saying, you know, we really need to deliver this Conservative victory, not just to deliver economic progress, but to make sure we get this referendum.
Something else that you can feel, which is that your leadership on Europe has failed to hold these people on board. They're very angry about the direction you've taken.
Well, I don't accept that. I think actually the referendum has been a great cause of unity in the Conservative Party. Now, I believe there is a renegotiation to be done that gets you guarantees on the single market, an end to ever closer union, better guarantees on immigration, a solution to many of the problems Britain finds in the EU.
Well, so
I believe that can be done.
Well,
now, but in the end, Jim, the proof will be for the British public. It won't be you, it won't be me. The British public will decide whether they want my renegotiated position in Europe or whether they want to leave altogether. But you can only have that choice with a Conservative government.
You said more than once in the course of the Scottish referendum campaign that you would be heartbroken if Scotland left. What word would you choose to describe your feelings if, under your watch as Prime Minister, Britain left the EU?
I feel about 1,000 times more strongly about our United Kingdom than I do about the European Union. I believe it's, if I've said before, if I didn't think it was in Britain's interest to be in the EU, I wouldn't argue for it. I think the best answer for Britain is a reformed position in the EU, because we're a trading nation. We don't just want access to those markets. We want to say over the rules. But let's be frank, it's not working properly for us at the moment. The single currency has driven a process of change that has alienated many people in Europe, and I'm one of the few leaders in Europe who's addressing this issue rather than trying to sweep it under the carpet.
So it wouldn't break your heart?
Well, the United Kingdom was an issue of heartbreak. This is a matter of important pragmatism. What is best for our United Kingdom? How do we get the best deal for Britain? That is what I feel strongly about.
Prime Minister, thank you very much.